experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down," and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which of course we believed killed the man.
The Striker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Striker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He opened one tent. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army. Right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq, the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he was not capable. He was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD. And it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day, basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. We've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, sickening. That's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image: American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts, and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out: "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what what's going on.
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior? The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception. But just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times that these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Thank you. Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I got to tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Since Russia started its special operation in Ukraine, the authorities of this country have continuously announced that their main goal is to prevent the plots and expansionist measures of the NATO and the US, and that they want to save the people of eastern Ukraine from Kiev government's repressions and also denazify this country. President Vladimir Putin and other senior officials also warned that the West has targeted the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Russia. And by distorting and rewriting history, they want to take away the right of this sovereignty from Russian citizens and to prevent their unity and integrity. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The RIA Novosti reports, President Vladimir Putin said on Tuesday, November 15th, that despite hostile attempts to undermine Russian sovereignty, the country managed to put a barrier on them. He noted that such attempts always start with an installation of historical myths instead of reality, pointing out the Ukrainian case. Putin said at a meeting of the Russian Patriotic Education Committee, Pobeda attempts by a number of states to rewrite, reshape world history are becoming more and more aggressive, and by and large, they have an obvious goal in relation to our society to divide, disorient, and weaken Russia, ultimately undermining its sovereignty to loosen it. He added such a scenario as we see has been tested in some countries, including Ukraine and in a number of other states. There were attempts to do the same with our country, with Russia. But, as I already said, we put a barrier on them firmly and timely to defend our interest. Putin stressed that attempts to falsify history are part of a Western smear campaign against Russia, which aims to create a pretext for anti-Russian aggression. He drew a comparison between modern Ukrainian politicians and Nazi collaborators during the Second World War, who tried to conceal their treason and crimes against their own people. The president stressed that Russia's values remain solid, continuity of generations, respect for tradition, and firm moral guidelines. Moscow has repeatedly noted that Western states pursue anti-Russian policies, demanding the country act against its own national interests. At the same time, they turned a blind eye to many signs of neo-Nazi ideology in Ukraine, allowing Kiev to freely and openly praise Nazi collaborators and mass murderers as heroes, and to discriminate against the Russian-speaking population. Meanwhile, the TASS news agency writes Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Friday, November 4th, the West is seeking to cut the ground from under Russia by distorting its history, but these attempts are doomed to failure. He said at a meeting with historians and representatives of Russia's traditional religions on the 10th anniversary of the re-establishment of the Russian Historical Society and the Russian Military Historical Society, attempts are being continued to cut the ground from under us. Naturally, these attempts cannot change the past. They are doomed to failure. It is impossible to deprive the country of the victories won by our ancestors. Putin said when someone wants to deprive a state of its sovereignty and turn its citizens into vassals, they begin with rewriting the history of this state in a bid to deprive people of their roots, to erase their memory, adding that such approaches lead to tragedies of nations. He stressed such attempts have been made against Russia and they never stop, but we thwarted them timely, since our country's history and culture are the basis on national identity, our mentality, traditional values, and what is most important. They are the basis of Russian statehood. According to Putin, Russia's position on preserving historic memory irritates some European countries. He added, "It is a duty for the state, society, and naturally historians to defend our true history, our heroes, to raise the quality of historic education." Putin said the West recast the conscience of millions of people in Ukraine, imposing pseudo-values and trying to set fire to Russia's breakup. The head of a state said at a meeting with historians and religious figures, "Unfortunately, in Ukraine, they managed to introduce such pseudo-values into the conscience of millions of people that this led to the situation when they created actually anti-Russia on that territory, sowing hatred, abusing the conscience of people, and depriving them of their true history. All this was done to remold the conscience of millions, and they were very skillfully setting fire to our country's disintegration." Furthermore, the Russia Today Daily reports Russian Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev has sounded the alarm, warning Russian government officials that the United States want to weaken and destroy Russia. Patrushev warned on Tuesday, November 15th, at a government meeting held in the city of Bryansk. While Washington declares Russia a source of instability, it also fosters anti-Russian alliances, builds up military strength, deploys NATO forces at our border. Patrushev added the puppet Kiev regime, which took power through a coup that was supported by the U.S. and its closest allies, is being used as a battering ram against Russia, adding the U.S. goal is to weaken, disunite, and ultimately destroy our nation. The top security official noted that the U.S. officials will stop at nothing to achieve their selfish goals aimed at global supremacy, and to do it, the U.S. is pushing the world towards a global war through policies that pit other nations against each other. Patrushev also cited Ukrainian saboteurs who could infiltrate the country as another present threat to the nation. He warned attempts to infiltrate Russian territory by members of radical and extremist structures who seek to conduct sabotage activities and terrorist attacks have significantly increased. He said transport and energy sites were of particular interest to would-be plotters and stressed that all possible safety lapses at the strategic sites must be dealt with and fixed. The senior Russian security official revealed earlier this month that Russian special services had thwarted a terrorist attack by Kiev forces on Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Meanwhile, media reports revealed that the U.S. and British spies in Ukraine were creating a secret army to carry out terrorist attacks. British intelligence operatives are working to create and train a covert terrorist force in Ukraine assigned to attack Russian targets in Crimea on behalf of the Kiev government. Citing leaked documents, the Grey Zone reported that UK intelligence operatives signed an agreement with Ukraine to build the so-called Partisan Terror Army. The report said their plans called for the secret army to conduct sabotage and reconnaissance operations targeting Crimea. Precisely the kind of attacks witnessed in past weeks. Also recently, Moscow charged London with orchestrating the terrorist attack that damaged the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Moreover, President Vladimir Putin said Russia's confrontation with the neo-Nazi regime that emerged on the territory of Ukraine was inevitable. Had we not taken the corresponding actions in February, this would have been all the same, but only from worse positions for us. As Putin pointed out, some Western friends of Ukraine had driven the situation in that country to a stage when it turned to be suicidal for the Ukrainian people and fatal for Russia.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Ghanaian government recently announced its plans to buy oil products with gold rather than the United States dollar. Ghana is now joining a growing group of countries that have taken direct action against the U.S. dollar hegemony. The Vice President of Ghana speaks here on the decision by the country to buy oil products using gold instead of the United States dollar. Let's take a listen.
To address this fundamental challenge that we all face of the persistent depreciation and its impact on fuel, in utility prices, food, and so on, government has opted to implement a policy of using our gold to buy oil products. That is something new.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on Ghana's new policy to buy oil products with gold rather than U.S. dollar reserves. Several other countries have taken a similar move that will lead to continued shrinking of the United States' economic and geopolitical influence and an overall erosion of its global standing. The second segment of our program will be on the quest for justice by Kenyans who endured brutality during Britain's colonial rule over this East African nation. As Kenya marks its Independence Day this month, we are asking, will Britain really apologize and pay proper reparations for its horrendous crimes against the people of Kenya? Our experts will give us their incisive analysis of these topics, and you can also be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Ghana dumps U.S. dollar for gold. The government of Ghana has directed all large-scale mining firms to divest 20% of their entire stock of refined gold at their refineries to the country's central bank. Ghana's Vice President Mahamadou Bawumia has announced that the directive forms part of the country's efforts to use gold to purchase oil products. This global trend of dumping the United States dollar has been reflected since the beginning of this year. Many countries in the world are adopting a diversified strategy on their foreign exchange reserves, further reducing the share of the U.S. dollar.
The Vice President of Ghana elaborates on the decision to use gold instead of U.S. dollar reserves in purchasing oil products.
It is very simple. This is because the exchange rate, whether you are looking at the spot exchange rate or the forward exchange rate, will no longer directly enter the formula for the determination of fuel or utility prices once we implement this, because the purchases of fuel and for transport and utility is going to be in cedis. It's not going to be in dollars. So because you're buying that fuel with gold, that is where the exchange takes place. But once you sell that fuel, you sell it in cedis. And then the Bank of Ghana uses those cedis to buy more gold and buy the oil, you sell it, and then it goes around in that way. But essentially, you are taking the exchange rate out of the equation.
Well, to discuss Ghana's decision to dump the U.S. dollar, we have contacted John Failport, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
I'm honored to be with you.
Now, what, in your opinion, is the main factor behind Ghana's decision to buy oil products with gold rather than U.S. dollar reserves?
Well, the U.S. dollar is having a lot of inflation, and so it's paper money. It has little value, or has less value because of the inflation. So by transferring to the gold, it's more of a universal value, and they are doing this to internally to avoid the devaluation of their currency. And I think this is going to be a tendency worldwide.
The Ghanaian cedi has depreciated astronomically against major trading currencies, especially the U.S. dollar, since the beginning of the year. Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, has also admitted that the country is facing an economic crisis.
We are in a crisis. I do not exaggerate when I say so. I cannot find an example in history when so many malevolent forces have come together at the same time. But, as we have shown in other circumstances, we should turn this crisis into an opportunity to resolve not just the short-term urgent problems, but the long-term structural problems that continue to bedevil our economy.
The dumping of the United States is a fundamental policy shift in Ghana's economic policy and is expected to change the country's balance of payments. The phasing out of the dollar will also significantly reduce the persistent depreciation of the country's currency. Experts predict stability in prices after the policy is fully implemented.
It would appear that it will avoid poverty and stabilize prices, because countries in Africa, and I've lived in Africa, their money is pegged to the U.S. dollar, and prices go up much faster, and the money is much less value for the people working in the salaries of those countries. I lived in Tanzania, and so we had a very hard time. People I know who are living on Tanzanian salaries were having a very hard time. So this will stabilize prices.
In yet another move against U.S. dollar dominance, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe introduced gold coins into the market in July this year amid rising inflation and rapid depreciation of the local currency. Now, the introduction of the gold coins is part of the central bank's measures to tackle the country's currency crisis through exchange rate stabilization. Now, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, John Mangudya, explains here on the decision to launch the gold coins.
There is no another better product that can be used as a store of value other than gold. And therefore, it means that we do respect the people of Zimbabwe. We know what you've been going through in terms of the fear factor of losing value. And therefore, we are providing this gold coin, so a genuine gold coin, to ensure that at least you will save and you invest there.
Now, countries across the world are gradually moving away from reliance on the U.S. dollar, which is used by Washington as a weapon to pursue its interest. Will Ghana's decision be adopted by other African countries?
Is to return to a multilateral or multilateral approach, and obviously having better relations or good relations with Russia and China and other countries too, because Turkey, if you follow the sanctions campaign against Ethiopia, the U.S. really went after a lot of countries which Ethiopia wanted to deal with. So this is the tendency. And remember, the United Nations was built on the concept of sovereignty, sovereign equality of nations. Gabon is equal to the USA, even though it's much smaller. And if you're not sovereign, if the U.S. dollar controls your economy. So if they get a form of universal or more democratic, maybe not quite the right word, but I'll use the word anyway, form of trade, it increases your sovereignty. So I think that Africa is going to move.
Ghana is embroiled in a debt crisis and is negotiating a relief package with the International Monetary Fund. In recent months, demonstrators have been gathering in Ghana, capital Accra, to protest against the spiral inflation.
We can't do anything. If you go to the market, whatever you have, whatever amount you have, you can't buy anything in the market. The system is so hard.
People have to check and then look at how the dollar is moving faster. It's affecting business. It's affecting almost everything in this country.
Activists say Ghana cannot rely on the IMF and the World Bank to revive its economy, as these institutions are actually blamed for being part of the economic crisis in many countries.
We all know, those who study Africa know how the IMF imposes structural adjustment and imposes public policy on social spending. And so there are serious doubts whether Ghana can have a proper negotiation with the IMF. Now, it's up to Ghana to take care of this, and not me, because obviously it's a sovereign country. And I think they've thought it through, though, and they may be able to negotiate something and also deal with other BRIC countries and find economic solutions where they're not as totally dependent on the IMF.
The holders of the largest gold reserves in the world are Western countries. For instance, France, which basically doesn't have gold mines in France itself, has at least 2,500 tons of gold reserves. But Mali, which has about 19 fundamental mines, has less than 700 tons of gold reserves.
Now, why are African countries that produce gold and other strategic minerals still wallowing in poverty, while Western countries maintain massive gold reserves, yet they have no gold mines?
The next step for Africa will be to increase the prices for their raw materials. It's already happening. We know that Zambia is asking for better payment for the raw materials. This is going to be a major battle, and U.S., Canada, Europe are going to try and resist it, and these African countries are going to have to defend themselves. And there's one important factor in Africa is the new African free trade arrangement, which they're trying to work on. And I know in the African Bar Association, where I am a consultant or a friend, I don't know, the conference in Johannesburg at the end of July 2023 is going to focus on how to strengthen the African free trade and prevent the imposition of low prices in Africa.
The United States is not only gradually weakening as a superpower, but Washington is also facing another harsh reality, the decline of the U.S. dollar globally. Now, meanwhile, countries that have decided to take an independent path and dump the U.S. dollar have faced severe U.S. sanctions. Now, will Ghana face the same fate, and what should it do to caution itself from such a move?
Well, if the U.S. dares to impose sanctions on Ghana, it could turn against the U.S. because there are other places which Ghana can deal with. We all know about, obviously, the embargo or the trade boycott on Cuba, which is a cruel, which cost Cuba $100 billion, I think. We can see the problems in Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Syria, Iran, your country, North Korea. And so, but the sanctions, well, they're very wrong and it has to stop. They're not working as well as they might have. And your country is one of the best examples where they have kind of acted so resolutely that they probably will not end up having a deal with the U.S. and Europe.
Well, it's quite apparent that Ghana is not alone, as many countries are dumping the dollar amid a new multilateral world order. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall take a glance at Britain's colonial era atrocities in Kenya.
Britain's brutal colonial rule over Kenya. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Every year on the 12th of December, Kenyans mark the country's independence, which was regained after decades of struggle and resistance against Britain's brutal colonial rule.
The Mau Mau Uprising was a significant turning point in Kenyan history and a key factor in Kenya's relentless struggle for independence. According to historical accounts, the Mau Mau Uprising from 1952 to 1960 was a particularly brutal period of British colonial history. It is estimated that at least 11,000 people were killed during Britain's bloody crackdown of the Mau Mau resistance movement. Britain is yet to account for these horrendous crimes against humanity.
A Kenyan human rights lawyer says a commission of inquiry should be set up to probe British crimes in Kenya during the colonial era.
There needs to be set up a commission of inquiry. In my view, this is not something that can be left to the British government alone, because even the Kenya government has got responsibility.
Well, to discuss Britain's atrocities in Kenya during the colonial era, we contacted Dr. Firoz Manji, an author, academic, and activist. He's also a publisher at Daraja Press. Thank you for your time today, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Kenya, during the month of December, marks the anniversary of its independence, which was attained after a courageous struggle and resistance against a brutal British colonial rule. Now, as Kenyans mark 6 decades of independence, the British government has not been held to account for its crimes. What's the reason for this?
Well, the reality is that And I think we have to start from the point of view that it is neither the British government nor indeed the ruling elite of Kenya that has any interest in doing anything to compensate for the crimes that were committed against the people of Kenya. You talk about Kenya being celebrating independence. Well, I think the ruling elite has certainly achieved independence to do what it likes. But for the majority of people in Kenya, that's not the case. I think that people are today poorer now than they were, say, 40 years ago. And I think there's a really serious situation in which there will never be the kind of compensation that people are looking for the crimes that were committed by the British government.
The suppression of the Mau Mau resistance movement in Kenya is referred to as the most brutal clampdown in all British colonies. Historians say there is a massive cover-up of Britain's savage treatment of the Mau Mau. Will the truth of these atrocities ever be known?
Such a long time, and many of those who are survivors of the killings by the British of the liberation movements have died, and so their stories have yet to be captured. I think some of the best outstanding materials that have been published, and in some detail, has been Caroline Elkin's book on the Gulag in or the Kenya Gulag and the legacy of violence across the British Empire.
In mid-2013, the British government agreed to pay a paltry £19.9 million in compensation to over 5,000 Kenyans who had suffered abuse during the Mau Mau uprising. The British government has flatly refused to apologize for its crimes. In 2013, William Hague, the then Foreign Secretary, made a statement to the House of Commons and only expressed regrets over colonial-era atrocities and crimes in Kenya. One of the Kenyans who was tortured and abused by British forces said the compensation was nothing compared to the pain and suffering she endured.
I am not happy that for my children and husband, what is 300,000 shillings?
Britain paid meager compensation for colonial atrocities against the Mau Mau following a so-called out-of-court settlement. Now, the compensation amounted to about £3,000 for each of the nearly 5,000 of the living survivors of the atrocities. What's your take on this compensation?
Actually, an insult if one just looks at the robbery that took place, the looting that took place, and the continued extraction of wealth by not only Britain, but Britain's own master now, the United States of America. And so you have a situation where essentially the essence of British colonialism was to consider Africans as being less than human. That was what justified their colonial, not just the colonial venture, but the venture of capturing Africans and forcing them into becoming slaves and their exploitation in the Caribbean and in the Americas. It is that huge, horrendous exploitation that they carried out.
Two Kenyan tribes are taking the UK to the European Court of Human Rights over abuses in the final decades of British colonial rule. The Talai and Kipsigis want £168 billion and an apology for crimes linked to a land grab in Kericho, a western area of Kenya which grows tea for some of the world's biggest producers. There is doubt if these Kenyan communities will eventually get justice.
For me, the thing that I think we have to evolve from is that we cannot expect those who were the criminals, we cannot expect those who benefited from and who tortured, who killed, who looted and continue to loot, we cannot expect to them to be the those who give justice.
Britain presents itself as a champion of human rights and democracy globally, yet it refuses to apologize for its brutal past while avoiding to pay reparations for its crimes. What's your take on these double standards?
Well, Britain's claim to be an upholder of human rights just simply does not hold any water. I mean, even one talks of Britain's nearest colony in Ireland, if one looks at what has happened there, they have never respected human rights. They have respected, put it this way, they respect human rights for those who they believe to be human. And the reality is, if you are not considered human, you do not have the right to those rights. So that is the situation that has been permanently a feature of British colonial and its continued post-colonial domination in the world, that it is unwilling to recognize that people that they think are not or less than human should have access to those rights. It's stark hypocrisy.
Well, there you have it. Britain's double standards in human rights is a classic case of hypocrisy. Thank you very much, Professor Feroz Manji, for your insight today. That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
According to recent reports, hate crimes against Muslim communities across Canada increased by 71% in 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International said, in the early morning of December 12th, an intruder attempted to disrupt the morning prayers by attacking the imam at the Islamic Foundation of Toronto. A person walked in with his shoes inside the prayer area while the imam was leading the prayer at the mosque located in the city's east end. The intruder jumped over the congregants to reach the imam and not only shouted obscenities at him, but also pulled his beard several times. Two members of the congregation grabbed the assailant and held him until the police arrived. After preliminary investigation, the police took the assailant away, but said no charges would be laid. He was allowed to drive away in his own car. While it is fortunate that nobody was hurt, the imam was clearly shaken. According to eyewitnesses, the imam was shivering after the attack. No charges have been laid and the attacker was not taken into custody, police media officer Shannon Eames told CBC News. Police do not consider it a hate-motivated crime and the individual left the scene after it happened, Eames added. In a statement, the mosque said, "Our hearts are deeply troubled, and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned. We simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident." The statement went on, calling on police to keep all avenues of investigation open, including potential hate motivation. Some reports have suggested that the assailant is mentally disturbed. It has become common to declare any assailant who attacks Muslims or their places of worship as mentally deranged. If a Muslim is involved in such activity, he is not only immediately branded a terrorist, but the entire Muslim community is vilified. The recent attack on the Islamic Foundation is the latest in a string of attacks on mosques across Canada. In September 2020, 58-year-old Muhammad Aslam Zafis was stopped and killed outside a mosque in Rexdale. Zafis was a volunteer caretaker who was checking to ensure congregants wore a mask before entering the prayer facility. His assailant, Gullihirm Van Nutkim, 34, attacked Zafis and slit his throat with a knife. On January 29, 2017, six members of the Quebec City Mosque were murdered in cold blood and another 19 injured. The assailant, 28-year-old Alexander Bissonnette, entered the mosque while the Muslims were offering night prayers. He was armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle as well as a pistol. Mercifully, the children were playing downstairs in the basement, otherwise many of them, too, would have fallen victim to the terrorist anti-Muslim rage. An equally horrific attack occurred in London, Ontario on June 6, 2021. Three generations of Afzal family were crushed to death by Nathaniel Veltman, who drove his van over them repeatedly. While the latest attack on the Islamic Foundation of Toronto mercifully did not result in any injuries, it would be wrong to assume that such attacks won't occur in the future. Unfortunately, it is open season on Muslims in Canada.